I had one horrendous night on Rakshi, which is a sort of a distilled spirit that they make, and it's quite the most revolting stuff. It's a bit like it's the colour of Sambuca when you put water into it. It goes that cloudy colour, but it doesn't take anything as nice as Sambuca. It's really rough. And I remember the next morning thinking my head had been split open. God, it was dazzling. But I learned my lesson. I didn't have too much more Rakshi after that. But no, eat anything, drink anything, and survive without a problem. So that was quite gratifying.
And where about did the gentleman disappear that had the photographs and that? Was that when she came back, or was he on the trip with you?
He was on the trip with us. And when we got back to the UK, he did a bunk, literally. We didn't have any suspicion of what was going on, but he embezzled quite a lot of money and took everything that he had with him, because he was the pay corps staff sergeant. He was, he was seen as the man for the admin man, and we would go and do other things. The other thing about Staff Guy was that he had a glass eye, literally a glass eye, and he could take this eye out of its socket and hold it in his hand. And he had another glass eye, which had red veins in it. So if he'd been drinking, he'd put the other one back in. And he amazed the locals, because he would bring these two glass eyes and he would put them up to his eyes and screw them out, and he'd show the locals these two eyes in his hands. And they couldn't believe this, because then he'd put them back in, or he'd put one back in and the other one he would just open up, and then he could see normally, and they thought this was just amazing. Just amazing. And Corporal Labruyere, the Scots Guardsman, he was covered in tattoos, and they couldn't stop touching him. They were just amazed by this bloke with all these some very good paintings, tattoos on his body. But those lads were, oh dear.
And were the people themselves, I know we all know the Gurkhas, but apart from the Gurkhas, were the people, well, them as well, so, but were they quite primitive, how they were living?
Yeah, it was pretty primitive. I have to say, the men are as idle as sin. The women work extremely hard. They do most of the carrying, the cooking, the field work. Men just seem to sit around. I'm not saying them all, but it just struck me how idle the men were compared to the women. But that seems to be the way out there. That's what happens. Primitive living? Well, by our standards, yes. But I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it. You've got your straw hut. You've got your lovely open fire, you've got your chickens, you've got your pigs, your goats, and it's self-sufficiency. And we had a great time. We had eight Sherpas working with us, who would carry our stuff. We would carry small packs, but they would carry the bulk of the stuff. I always got involved in the cooking. I was up quite early, and so I got involved in what was going on, and it just made it all the better for me. I even read some books. Would you believe it? I read some books. I'd never read books. But I did read, I think, in the nine or so weeks we were there, I think I read three books, which for me is just phenomenal. I tell you, God.
I'm surprised you got books with you, because I wait and,
You can buy them out there.
Oh, okay.
Nepal has been for years the hippie centre of the world. And there is you go to Kathmandu and you'll find that there are just, shops full of stuff that people have brought in and then have sold or given away, and they end up in there to be bought. So you just went round and you could buy, plenty of things. But we bought some books, just paperback books, and read those. And when we came back to Kathmandu eventually, just gave them away again. I remember eating buffalo. Now there's the treat for you. You've got to eat some buffalo. It is gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous.
Is it tender?
Oh, just melts in your mouth. Just amazing. And once you've been eating chicken for 6 or 7 weeks, a bit of buffalo does go down well.
And when you said it was a hippie kind of centre as well, especially during that period when you think of it, did you see a lot of Europeans?
Yeah, a lot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of people, I don't know, who were trying to find themselves. They were a bit hippie-ish. We had a reason to be there, but a lot of these folks there's obviously quite a big drugs culture out there. I'm not talking about perhaps some of the serious drugs we hear about these days, but sort of marijuana and pot and maybe some LSD and stuff, but there were people out there who were obviously on this stuff, because when you talk to them, it didn't make any sense at all, and they were pretty wacky. They'd have all kinds of silly things in their hair and face painted, and you know, just. But you just said, okay, you're wacky. You do your own thing. We're going to do something else. I was only a young man. I was only 19, 20 then. Yeah, and this is all very new to me. John Titley, the captain who was with us, he'd seen it all before, and he'd probably actually been one of these hippies in his day, because he was a bit older than us. He'd have been 30-ish. But it was an interesting place. Interesting place. We had one occasion when we were camping by a loch, or a lake, sorry, they call it, and somebody had cut open the tent of one of the lads and had got in and cut open these bergen and taken some stuff. And the next night we sort of, this guy obviously got thought it was too easy, and he tried again in one of the other tents, and he put his hand through and was grabbing around, and one of the lads just took his machete and went right across his wrist, and it worked perfectly. Because that guy never came back. Probably bled to death. But you just told the police, and they were on the lookout for a guy with a hand hanging off. But yeah, that's the way it was. I mean, that's how it is.
When you went out, on the pension pay rounds as well, did you ever stay in any other houses? Did you actually stay overnight? Or?
We did stay. We never stayed in the. They would always make us most welcome, and they would always lay on, the elders would always lay on a function. So this is a big occasion when, it was important for the old Gurkhas and the village elders that we were there, and we were able to take their hospitality and repay it. And that's why we would build something or help do something or give some medicine, because quite a few of them were not very well. So we had medicine, and we were able to provide them with some basic medical treatment, and we had a medic with us, so that was useful. They always, when we were going to stay somewhere specifically, there would always be a house laid aside for us. It would be one or two rooms in a house, or it would be the village hall. That's where you're going, they were always immaculate. Everything had been cleaned, and the floor was swept with leaves. It was a great experience.
It does sound it. And could the old Gurkhas, could they speak English? Or could most people speak English?
No. To be fair, most of them spoke only Gurkhali, or whatever dialect it was of Gurkhali. Fortunately, John Titley, was a Gurkha, and therefore he spoke Gurkhali. So where there was a situation that somebody needed to talk to us, he would do the translating, because that's the main reason why there was a Gurkha there, and he was in charge of this thing. The rest of us had limited Gurkhali. We could pass the time of day and be say niceties and good morning, good afternoon, good evening, thank you very much indeed, that's very kind, all this sort of stuff. But he could carry on conversations for hours.
Okay, and you mentioned clothing as well. You mentioned the kilt. Did you have like a lightweight clothing or anything, or was it the heavy stuff?
No, we just had adventure training stuff, so it was all, well, it gets very cold at night, so you need to have something that's warm. But during the day, it was just, you would wear a pair of lightweight trousers and a t-shirt and a hat and sun cream and a pair of sunglasses. And that was really it. And then you'd carry your stuff, you'd have a bergen, or not a particularly heavy one, and then at night you just put some thicker stuff back on.
And was there ever a threat that you might get bitten or anything like that out there?
What, from snakes and stuff?
Well, I'm trying to think, are mosquitoes out there, or?
I don't recall any insect problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were snakes, and there were other things out there, but. I don't recall anybody having any problem with insects or scorpions or anything like that.
And was there a threat from anything else as you were walking up these tracks? Or
well, there's elephants and tigers. So you had to just be aware. Not that we didn't see any up westwards. We went down to the national park in the south of Nepal before we left. we went out and we saw the signs of tiger, didn't see any, but saw the signs of them.
But elephants?
Did yeah, well, we were actually with elephants, so didn't see any wild ones, but saw plenty of other things, plenty of deer, birds of prey, and smaller animals, but I didn't see any wild elephants or any wild tigers, but we have to be fair, we were only actually at the game reserve for one day. But we saw the signs of wild tiger.
It sounds a fantastic experience.
Oh, it was great. Yeah, absolutely great. Mm-hmm. And I'd never really been, yeah, I've been to Cyprus, okay, but I've never really been anywhere else. I went to Germany when we were at Santos for our final exercise, but you're on exercise then, so... no, it was tremendous. And it was a reward for the work we put in on the training side at Warminster. You know, that's why I was selected. Not just to be the second in command of the thing, but also the fact that I'd actually put in quite a lot of hours and work for the IDV. So it was a nice thank you.
I had thought, you know, when you first started to speak about it as well, I had thought of the poverty, you know, did you see the poverty? And I was actually quite surprised when you said, you know, the method of travel on the train. I thought it would have been at least second class. So you did really see it. You were actually experiencing it, both within the train and on the bus.
Wherever we went, you know, it was you just, you had to fit in to what was going on. And we probably took the wrong option. We thought we'd get to the bus early and get seats inside. Well, we were too late, and the bus was full. And actually, I have to say, it was a much better experience being on the roof. Unfortunately, it didn't rain until the last bit, until the guy turned left instead of going straight on. But otherwise, it was great.
Okay, and did you just go back to Warminster after that?
Yeah, we finished. We finished our pension paying and went back to Warminster, and then just got back into the swing of where we were. And just picked up the bits and got on with it.
One question I did need to ask you, and I'll apologise for that, is about the Gurkha camp. Was it like how we would associate a military camp here, or was it totally different?
No, it was very similar to what we'd experienced here. Very clean, very tidy, well organised, purpose-built huts. They weren't Nissen huts, they were proper roofed, box profile roofed huts. Air conditioned, very smart.
Okay.
Very smart.
Okay, so sorry about that. So we're back to Warminster, and the other query I had about that as well was this 2-year period. Did you have any connection with the Gordons then?
Excuse me. Not really. I mean, we used to see young officers coming through on their courses, and you know, you'd meet people coming through on their courses, but. No, the Gordons were doing their own thing in Chester, and I was doing whatever I had to do at Warminster. So that was quite different.
And did you know you were only going to be there for a 2-year period, or you know, how did you know when you first got told that you were going there?
I knew I was doing a 2-year period there, and while I was there, I went away and I did the Sniper's Instructors course because I was one of the. We had a lovely guy called Sergeant Major Sandy Bissett, Green Jacket. He was a very keen rifle shot, and because we were keen to make a name for ourselves within the infantry, so we put together a shooting team to go to Bisley, which is the big Army Rifle Association meeting, and we had a standard team. My Sergeant Major Bissett is the team captain. He also shot. I was the young officer, and then we had. The other lads, all of whom were pretty good shots, and we did incredibly well. We trained under Sergeant Major Bissett at Warminster and at Mere Ranges, just to the south of Warminster. We went to Bisley, and we really did actually pretty well. 5 of us got into the top 100, which for the first time was phenomenal. And I think of all the units there, we ended up something like 14th, which was a real boost. Anyway, I've always enjoyed shooting, so I went away when I got back and did the Sniper's Instructors course. So I got my sniper badges and became a sniper instructor, which I then used throughout the remainder of my career for various things, which was great. So that I felt that was a real boost for me, because I've always enjoyed being in that thing, and that's when I went back to the Gordons eventually. I was able to implement the things that I'd learnt on the sniper's course into the reconstituted reconnaissance platoon, which we'll come on to in later interviews. But it was a good experience, Bournemouth.
And when you say snipers as well, I always associate a sniper, you know, with the maybe a terrorist or something. You know, like I think you mentioned it in our last interview where you had to be careful if there were children playing or something.
Yeah.
And so when it's in like the military side of things, how does it differ from normal shooting type of thing?
Well, snipers are, they're, how would you put it? A sniper on his own is just a sniper, but you tend to put a platoon of snipers together and they work in pairs. So there'll be a sniper and an observer. And the observer is a sort of bodyguard to the sniper. So the two of you work together. And then the commanding officer is able to deploy a number of sniper teams in whatever role he fancies. It could be in a forward harassing fire role. It could be in a forward observation role. It could be in a flank observation role. Or it could be in a counter-terrorist role, i.e. you're specifically there to shoot dead somebody who's going to come down that path. And they know that somebody's going to come down that path. So you could employ snipers in the urban environment in Belfast, specifically to look for somebody. You could have somebody deployed in a rural environment, again, with the sole purpose of killing somebody. Or you can use them in a role where you get them to shoot the optics out of a vehicle so that the driver or the commander is unable to see what's going on, and therefore that vehicle slows down and it slows the whole process of the enemy coming towards you. So there are lots of different things that snipers can be used for. They're a very employable, low-cost resource. And with the movement of technology, the weapons and the sights available to them now are better than they were in my day. And you know, it's a very important tool, and one that I think is now coming back into favour within the army, because it takes a specific sort of person to do it. I've known quite a few good young men who've done very well on the theory and very well on aspects of the course, but when they actually came to shooting something live, dead, they didn't quite have it. There was a mentality. You know, you go out and one of the final things you do is you shoot deer. As part of the culling process, it's an officially recognised thing you do. You go to an estate and you help them cull some deer. So the snipers are deployed in such a way that as if they were doing it for real. They go out, they occupy a hide, they make an OP, they dig holes, they live in there for 2 or 3 days, and when the deer come to them, they have to shoot X amount of deer. Well, some of these lads, when you actually get to that point and they bring the weapon up to bear and the rounds in the chamber and the sights they have a problem actually pulling the trigger. Or if they pull the trigger, they pull it, and therefore the deer is not hit cleanly and it runs away and dies a nasty death. You don't know that until you actually do it. That's the problem. And some of these guys haven't got the ability. Others are just phenomenal, completely clinical, absolutely no problem. And that's the sort you need. But there again, that sort, they've got to be able to live with somebody, because quite a few of these guys are able to live on their own, and they don't mix with anybody. And therefore, you have concerns there. So the sniper platoon are a very useful tool. And I was just chuffed a bit to get the opportunity to go and do the course and get my badge and my instructor's label, because I was able then to go back and continue this and use this in a different way within the battalion when I got back to them.
I wondered when you said, you know, when it came to the point that they couldn't do it, because I thought in most situations like that, would it not be a them or a you type of situation? You know, if you didn't shoot, they might...
Possibly, but you would hope that a sniper's got himself in a position where he's has not been observed by the enemy. Because that's the whole point of them. A sniper should... Most engagements with small arms fire are done under 250 metres, 250 yards. That's the reality. But a sniper should be taking people out at 6 to 1,000 yards. So you've got no idea where that shot's come from.
So they are hidden. They're not like.
Oh, God, yeah.
So they're not meeting someone in a lane or something.
No.
Okay.
No, these guys are. They should be absolute masters of the art of camouflage and concealment.
Okay.
So that's the purpose of them.
So the hide, like in the deer situation, would be the similar thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And when you mentioned there as well that if the trigger wasn't pulled cleanly, was it? For somebody who doesn't know guns, what does that mean?
Right, you can snatch at a trigger. I mean, the triggers normally have two pressures. You've got a take-up pressure, and then the second squeeze brings the hammer forward, which hits the base of the round, which sends the bullet down the barrel and away. You can, if you're a bit jumpy, pull it, snatch it. So you're forgetting to take up the first pressure. You're going straight from nothing to bang. When you do that, the rifle butt will normally slip down or up your shoulder, and therefore there'll be where the bullet goes, it will drop, or probably go left or right, high or low, and therefore you've pulled the shot, which means that you're not going to get a clean kill.
Okay. And was there a particular type of weapon that was better, you know, for a sniper?
Well, snipers use the heavy duty L42A1 sniper rifle, purpose built rifle, heavy barrel. You can put a modifier on it, so you've got a silencer on the end of it. You can fit some pretty large telescopic sights and night viewing devices to it. So it's an all-weather capability, this thing. You know, rain, sunshine, whatever. It's a big, long rifle, though, and they weigh quite a bit.
I was wondering about the size of it, and also, did they have that capability back in 1980?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. It's been, I mean, snipers are nothing new. I mean, the snipers have been around... since the Boer War, there's always been guys who are better shots, but they developed, I mean, in the First World War, both Germans and the Brits had snipers operating in trenches, and that's how you just pick people off. You know, some sentry would stick his head up and bing, hit in the top, sniper. Just sitting there in the middle of nowhere, lying in a hole for days. It takes a really strong character to be a sniper, because of the, I mean, there's some, if, I don't know where you've watched, there's a film, I forget what it's called, about the Russians and the Germans at Stalingrad. There's an excellent film about snipers there, which really brings it home what these guys are all about. And, you know, I've actually shown that film to potential snipers and said, this is the sort of thing you're going to have to, you get used to. Forget the fact that this is, you know, Stalingrad was the most horrendous battle, and there was plenty going on, but just some of the scenes that were there were, you know, absolutely what you would have to expect a sniper to do.
Okay, and you mentioned a second person there as well.
Yeah.
What was that second?
The second person is basically the observer and come bodyguard. He does not have a sniper rifle. That person has a personal protection weapon, which. It might be an ordinary rifle, it could be a small arms 80, it could be, as it was when I was there, was we had the submachine gun, the little submachine gun. You could have a pistol, you could have an Uzi, you could have a Minimi or whatever. But this guy basically has a rapid-fire weapon that if you're overrun, he can use it in the locality, because a sniper rifle is a great big long weapon. You can only have five or six rounds on the rifle any one time. So you can't just go, you know, bang, 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 bang. You've got to hang left. But these small personal weapons can, you know, put out a lot of fire.
And, you know, say you're in a situation where there could be people around Northern Ireland or wherever, how do you manage to transport these weapons? You know, if you're trying to get this chap in a situation where he's not seen, they must be quite big. And
yeah, they are, but some of the newer ones, you can actually unscrew the barrels and you can put them into small pieces. They're not, I mean, the old ones I used to use, that was a big long rifle, and you just had a case and that was it, and it was just, you know, this thing about 4.5 feet tall. But these days, some of the rifles, you can unscrew the barrels, the stocks come apart, the sights are a separate thing, so when you get into it, you've probably got a thing that's sort of like an average suitcase, not very big at all.
Okay.